From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Springtime means the renewal of baseball, and for one major league pitcher, the chance to add a 24th season to his resume. Ahead in Only a Game, a profile of 47-year-old Phillies hurler Jamie Moyer. Also, the Mariners attempt a Seattle revival, forecasting the Final Four's final 2010 Fandangos, and the 90-year-old murder mystery featuring one of golf's innovative swingers. Also, competitive pole dancers elevate their sport to greater heights.
Guys go to strip clubs for what they go to strip clubs for. This is completely different. This is a performance art that just happens to use a vertical pole.
What? Am I on? I'm on? I don't know what to say other than stay tuned. Boy, it's hot in here.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tomorrow marks the beginning of the Major League Baseball season, meaning that by Wednesday, Kansas City and Pittsburgh will have given up. Nah, I'm just kidding. Much of what's excellent about the beginning of each season is the hope, fatuous or not, that each new beginning brings, and the hope won't fade that fast. As of today, theoretically, your favorite team could go undefeated, especially if it drafts Maya Moore and Tina Charles and turns the managerial duties over to Gino Auriemma. But even without that sort of radical approach, virtually every team but the Yankees is looking to improve over last season's performance, and some number of those teams, the Seattle Mariners, for example, would seem to have reason to believe it could happen. The Seattle Mariners are coming off an 85-win campaign, and they acquired one of baseball's top pitchers over the winter. They open the year on the road against Oakland on Monday night. Joining me now to discuss the Mariners' chances this season is Larry Stone, the national baseball writer for the Seattle Times. Larry, welcome to Only a Game.
My pleasure.
The Mariners picked up Cliff Lee from Philadelphia as part of a four-team deal. However, the 2008 Cy Young Award winner is suffering presently from an abdominal strain, and he's appealing a five-game suspension for throwing at Arizona's Chris Snyder in a spring training game. Do you expect Lee to get back on track?
He also had foot surgery, too, so it's been a rocky time for Cliff Lee with Seattle, and he's yet to throw his first pitch. He's had this injury, this abdominal injury, twice before in his career, and both times it lingered and led to off-season, so there's a little bit of trepidation here. They're hoping that he'll be back in late April or early May and be able to give them what they had hoped for when they traded for him, but there's some concern because this is a kind of injury for a pitcher that has a tendency to linger.
If and when he does return to the mound, Lee will join a rotation that also includes 24-year-old Felix Hernandez. Hernandez went 19-5 during a breakout season last year. Does he do that again in 2010?
Absolutely. And I think he's firmly established now as one of the top pitchers in the league. This is a guy who came up to the majors as a teenager, and everyone knew he was going to be a star. But last year, everything kind of came together, experience, talent, work ethic. I believe everyone in baseball believes this guy will be sort of a top-flight number one pitcher for the next decade.
In 2009, Ichiro Suzuki set a record with his ninth straight season of 200 or more hits. He's been obviously extremely consistent and durable as well throughout his major league career. But he is 36 years old. Is Ichiro showing any signs of slowing down?
You know, you'd think that he would. He's a guy whose game is really reliant on speed, and I keep waiting for the day that he stops beating out all those infield singles. But last year, he had 57 infield singles, the most in baseball. And he keeps himself in such tremendous shape that, really, I think he is the same Ichiro that he's been for the last decade.
Another familiar name on the Mariners roster is also getting old, older than Ichiro, in fact, by 4 years, and very old by baseball standards. Last season, Ken Griffey Jr. returned to Seattle, where he had his best years before leaving back in 1999. Are the Mariners counting on Griffey for production, or did they bring him back just because he was such a popular guy there?
Most fans are delighted to have him back, and it was, you know, a huge success last year. He got standing ovations all year long. But he's going to hit fifth in the lineup as the designated hitter against right-handed pitching, and that's a production spot. So there's some fans who wonder if the Mariners are emphasizing sentiment over production.
The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim have won three straight American League West titles, but longtime Angels star Vladimir Guerrero is with Texas now. John Lackey has moved over to Boston, and of course your Mariners grabbed third baseman Sean Figgins. Still, you have picked the Angels to win another division title. How so?
You know, I look at their pitching staff, and they can throw out a good starter on the mound every night. I think they're the only team in the division that can do that. They did add Hideki Matsui to replace Guerrero. They have a highly touted young player, Brandon Wood, who's going to replace Figgins. And they have one of the best managers, certainly in baseball, in Mike Scioscia. I still think they've got enough to pull this out, but I think it's going to be very competitive. Texas is going to be good, and Oakland is on the rise.
The Mariners won 116 games way back in 2001, but they lost in their second straight ALCS appearance. That was Ichiro's first season in the majors, and also Seattle's last trip to the postseason. If you think the Angels will win in the West, what's the likelihood the Mariners get to the playoffs via the wild card this year?
Well, I don't have high hopes for that. I subscribe to, I believe, what most people think is that the wild card will come, as it usually does, out of the AL East. The loser of the Yankee Red Sox showdown in the East, the poor Rays, might be the third best team in baseball and could end up on the outside.
If you're right, I mean, come on. Opening day is supposed to be all about, hope, resiliency, et cetera. And you're picking the Mariners not to make it to the playoffs. This must be kind of a gloomy way to approach the season.
I'm usually wrong with my prediction, so that's probably a cause for much optimism and celebration by Mariner fans when I pick against them, because that's usually a good sign that they're going to do quite well. You know, on the rare occasions when you nail one, you do get to gloat a little bit, but most of the time, you're not going to be right.
Larry Stone is the national baseball writer for the Seattle Times. Larry, thanks very much for speaking with me.
All right, my pleasure.
Precisely 4 years ago, Only a Game's Ron Schachter profiled New York Mets slugger Julio Franco, who was 47 at the time. During the 2010 spring training season, Mr. Schachter caught up with another 47-year-old major leaguer who, amazingly, is a starting pitcher. Here's his story.
One more time, infield in, bases loaded.
As the Philadelphia Phillies prepared for the regular season, the buzz around training camp was about the newly acquired ace, who's won 139 games over the past decade. Former Cy Young winner and Toronto Blue Jay Roy Halladay. There hasn't been much buzz about the pitcher who's won 140 games, the third most in baseball over the same time. That would be Jamie Moyer, who hardly looks the role as Phillies pitchers run through their fielding drills. Compared to the oversized frames and military haircuts of his fellow starters, Moyer barely measures 6 feet, and his dark hair hangs from the back of his baseball cap. But what distinguishes him even more, says Comcast Sportsnet reporter Jim Salisbury, is that he's also fast approaching his 48th birthday.
When some of us would hurt our shoulders starting our lawnmower, he's out there pitching in the best league in the world. He's got more wins now than, you know, Bob Gibson has. You could put him on the list of some of the greatest left-handed starters ever, but he doesn't get that acclaim because he has a game where we're enthralled with power, power bats and power arms, and he's not one of those guys. He's out there changing speeds and outthinking the hitter. That's not real sexy in the game, but it gets results.
So much so that going into his 24th major league season since he debuted with the Chicago Cubs in 1986, Moyer leads all active pitchers with 258 lifetime wins. In 2008, at age 45, he compiled a 16-7 record with a 3.71 ERA to help the Phillies win a world championship. That performance earned him a 2-year, $16 million contract extension, and last year he tied for the team lead with 12 victories. As he dresses in front of his locker and slips on a pair of green plaid dock shoes that only a senior citizen could love, Moyer says he doesn't feel that old.
I get the age question a lot, and, you know, I am 47. You know, should I have retired? Maybe, but I didn't feel like I should. And, you know, I think when guys get to a certain age or they get to a certain point in their life, they feel like they've either had enough or they've lost the drive to compete or to work out and stay in shape. whatever it may be, I haven't lost that yet. So my feeling is, you know what, if you haven't lost it, keep doing it.
That Moyer has kept at it is especially noteworthy since at age 32, his overall record stood at a mediocre 59-66. But at a time of life when the careers of most major league pitchers are winding down, Moyer's blasted off. First with the Seattle Mariners, and over the past 4 years with the Phils. Since 1996, he's compiled a stunning 197-111 record, including two seasons with 20 or more wins. It's helped that along the way, Moyer has played on teams with powerful offenses, and that he's averaged more than 30 starts a season. But he adds that he's made a living by using his wits, and by pinpointing his so-called fastball, which only reaches the low 80s, and bedeviling opposing batters with an assortment of off-speed pitches.
If you're an overpowering guy, and you don't necessarily have to pitch, but if you don't have overpowering stuff, you're going to have to pitch. It took me some time to learn that, but I have to be a pitcher, not a thrower. I'm trying to attack the strike zone with the stuff that I have, trying to force contact, rely on my defense, putting it in play on my terms rather than their terms.
For the Philadelphia Phillies, batting first, number 11, Jimmy Rollins, shortstop.
At a spring training game in Clearwater 2 weeks ago, plenty of fans wore jerseys bearing the last names of Philly sluggers Chase Utley and Ryan Howard, and there were even a few of the new Roy Halladay models. Although there didn't appear to be any with Moyer's name, he has his fans. 72-year-old James Richard, a semi-retired college psychology professor, is one.
I admire him. Yeah, I really do, in the sense of he pushes back the limits about when people should have to retire. And he hasn't just given any indication that he's going to stop or quit or retire. So I think that's a great thing.
This spring, Moyer had to compete for the final spot in the Phillies' rotation. He only secured his starting role last Friday by holding a potent Yankee lineup to one hit and no runs over 6 2/3 innings. For all of his success, Moyer has made it to the All-Star game just once. And despite his 258-195 lifetime record, he's seldom thought of as a future Hall of Famer, largely because his 4.22 career ERA far exceeds that of any other pitcher in Cooperstown. Moyer says he doesn't mind.
I kind of like to do this quietly. I like to come to work, do my job, and when it's time to go home, go home. I don't feel like I need to put myself on a pedestal. Not that anybody else does, but I don't need that. I don't necessarily want that. You know, I come here to work.
Moyer will get back to work for keeps a week from today when he's scheduled to pitch in Houston against the Astros. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Samir Mehta spends about 2 hours a day with his barber. Together, Mr. Mehta and that barber have created 57 different beard designs over the past 4 years. Enough beard designs for Mr. Mehta to gain recognition from the Limca Book of Records, which is India's version of the Guinness Book of Same. But all has not gone smoothly in Mr. Mehta's pursuit of fame, notoriety, or whatever it is he has achieved. His first beard design, which he called a 6 half-eggs beard, so embarrassed his wife that she refused to be seen with him. And there is no indication that this was his intention. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the tale of a revolutionary golf swinger and his unsolved murder. But first, here to discuss the penultimate promenades of the 2010 Big Dance, and perhaps to pick a winner, is ESPN's Pat Forty, who joins us from Indianapolis. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Before we get into this year's tourney, let's talk about the news this week that the NCAA is considering expanding the men's basketball tournament, something we reported actually a couple of weeks ago, so that everybody gets to play. Now, that's a slight exaggeration. So that 96 teams would be in the field. Do you think that's a fait accompli?
I think it is, Bill. After sitting through the very strenuous topspin from the NCAA Thursday, a 2,505-word filibuster without questions from Greg Shaheen of the NCAA on why we just simply can't live without a 196-team tournament. 96-team tournament. They gave many, many reasons about why this is a good thing and no reasons why it's a bad thing. They didn't say it's a done deal, but it was quite clearly a done deal.
You, however, could give them some reasons why it's a bad thing, right?
Oh, yeah, plenty. It's more than 2,505 words in response. I could easily. I think it is a catastrophically bad idea. I think it would ruin the best sporting event in America. It's not good for the players. It's certainly not good for the fans. It doesn't do anything for anybody other than give the TV networks a chance to sell more ads and the NCAA a chance to make a bigger contract with the TV stations.
Specifically, it diminishes the importance of the regular season, I gather, and certainly of the conference tournaments. Not good for those reasons.
Absolutely. Destroys the conference tournaments and renders the regular season largely meaningless. It's already, you know, I think almost to that point. The casual fan doesn't pay very much attention to college basketball until, you know, maybe mid-February or so, after the Super Bowl is over. Now, there's no point paying attention at all until maybe the second round of the NCAA tournament, because the first round is going to be fluff. It's going to be filler.
All right, let's gently ease back to a more sensible number than 96, and that number would be 4. In the first of today's men's semifinal games, Michigan State will face Butler. Are you as surprised and delighted as I am that we'll see a number 5 seed in the 2010 NCAA Finals?
Yeah, I love it. I think it's a great development. You know, both these teams come with great stories. They're very likable teams. You know, Michigan State having lost Kalen Lucas, their best player in the second round of the tournament to a torn Achilles tendon. A couple other guys playing hurt, but here they are again. Tom Izzo, the best coach in the country right now for my money. And then Butler is just a fabulous story. I spent all day, basically Tuesday, on the Butler campus. Small school, 4,200 students. A nice, you know, idyllic campus tucked into the western side of Indianapolis, and they're just, you know, over the moon over this. It's obviously a first for them and for a school from the Horizon League. It's a wonderful accomplishment and a great story.
Well, the Horizon League notwithstanding, your friend and mine, Charlie Pierce, asserted recently that it is time to stop thinking of Butler as a mid-major. You agree with that?
I do. You know what? I mean, the easy parallel here has been Hoosiers and Hickory High School, and they're not Hickory, but they are Milan High School, which is the real-life Hickory. Bobby Plump, who made the shot, he was Jimmy Chitwood in the movie.
Right.
Went to Butler, and I went and talked to him, and he said, you know, they are like Milan, this team, because they were just a small school that happened to be excellent. And I think Butler now moves to the head of the, you know, quote-unquote mid-major class. They are, you know, a legitimate year-in, year-out national player.
All right, tonight's other semifinal pits, Duke against West Virginia. Some feel that the topsy-turvy nature of the first three rounds of the tournament paved the way for an easy Duke stroll to the championships. But is getting by West Virginia going to be that easy for the Blue Devils?
I don't think so, no. I think West Virginia wins what should be just a battle, though. This Duke team is not like some of the others that were finesse-oriented. You know, they've got four big guys who are very physical and rugged and can really hold their own inside. And West Virginia makes a living crashing the offensive glass and hammering people on the defensive end. So I think it's going to be a real tough man contest in there. This Duke team is the best Duke team in years, but I don't know if they're good enough to beat West Virginia.
All right, so you like West Virginia over Duke. Who do you like winning the whole thing?
I like Butler to beat Michigan State, and then I like West Virginia over Butler in the championship game Monday night.
Pat Forde's 40-yard dash column appears on the ESPN website. He joins me from time to time to talk men's hoops here on Only a Game. Thanks, Pat.
Thank you, Bill. Enjoy the weekend.
UConn will face Baylor, and Oklahoma will take on Stanford in tomorrow's Women's Division I semifinals. Joining me now to discuss the fairer, or perhaps, as it turns out, the less fair big dance, is Michelle Smith, the national women's basketball writer for AOL Fanhouse and the editor of LeftCoastHoops.com. Michelle, in their four tournament games thus far, UConn's margins of victory have been 56, 54, 38, they must have slipped that night, and 40 points. The Huskies' opponents have averaged a scant 40 points per game. So, how many shots does Baylor's Brittany Griner have to block to stop Connecticut's winning streak at 76?
Many, many, many shots. But, you know, I will say this. Baylor is, it gets interesting at least. Brittany Griner is the biggest freshman in the country, the hottest freshman in the country. And so we get a little intrigue. I mean, you're at least going to be a little curious about how it goes for, I don't know, half or so. So, you know, I think that this is a fun matchup. I think a lot of people are going to be interested to see this.
Maya Moore is the UConn star player with whom people are most familiar, but she's had a lot of help in this tournament. Who are some of the rest of the Huskies who've contributed to the team's unprecedented success?
Well, Maya's a great player, and yet I don't think she's going to be the National Player of the Year. I think it's going to be her teammate, Tina Charles, the center, who's had a great season. You know, Tina's taken her lumps from Gino Auriemma over the years. He has called her out publicly, and they've gone back and forth, and he has challenged her through her first few years of college basketball. And this year, she's just taken her game to a completely different level, and I think Tina's going to be the National Player of the Year. And then they've got Kalena Green, and they've got Carolyn Doty. I mean, this is a very talented team. These are not supporting players in almost any other sense on any other team in the country. These are star players.
On the other side of the bracket, you told us earlier this season that Stanford is quite capable of staging the upset of all upsets. Is this also true of Stanford's semifinal opponent, Oklahoma?
Oklahoma's got 10 losses. They were in the Big 12, which clearly is the best conference in the country when you've got two teams in the Final Four, and the two teams that were seated above them didn't make the Final Four. But Oklahoma's a very good team. Oklahoma is not a great team, I don't think. I think this is a team that's played really well. They're playing very consistently. They've got a hot player in their shooting guard, Naisha Stevenson. But I don't see the Sooners making the big run.
All right, it's time for you to take your best guess about how both semifinals will shake out. And while you're at it, you got to pick us a national champion, even though that might be awfully difficult this year.
Okay. Oklahoma-Stanford, I'm going to go with Stanford. I think Oklahoma's a very good team, and in the backcourt they will give the Cardinals some trouble, but Abby Olajuwon is a bit by herself under the basket, and with Jaina Pelineka Ogumike and even Kayla Peterson, I think that, you know, three very good post players outduels one. I would say it's going to be Connecticut, obviously, against Baylor, but I think it could be fun for a while, and then I see the Huskies finishing the job.
Michelle Smith is the national women's basketball writer for AOL Fan House and the editor of LeftCoastHoops.com. She joins us from time to time to talk women's college hoops. Thanks again, Michelle.
Thank you for having me.
You've heard of Tiger Woods, whether for good or ill, and perhaps you're familiar with names like Phil Mickelson or Jack Nicklaus. You've probably not heard of J. Douglas Edgar, but according to Steve Eubanks, the author of a new book about Mr. Edgar, if you're a golfer with a good swing, J. Douglas is the guy you should thank. The title of Steve Eubanks' book is To Win and Die in Dixie, The Birth of the Modern Golf Swing and the Mysterious Death of Its Creator, and Steve Eubanks joins me now from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Welcome to Only a Game, Steve.
Thanks. Good to be here.
J. Douglas Edgar was teaching people the golf swing characterized by what he called the movement during the second decade of the 20th century. What is the movement?
The movement really is what you would see on every driving range at every tour event these days. It is the modern golf swing, turning the upper body around a fairly steady lower body base. The golf club never gets parallel to the ground, and a lot of force is generated right at the moment of impact. This was very different from the golf swing of the early part of the 20th century, where there was a lot of lateral movement, a lot of hip turn, a lot of casting of the golf club. The longer the swing, the better. Edgar, because of his physical limitations, he had a bad hip, was unable to do that. And so through a lot of trial and error, he was able to determine that by keeping the lower body very steady, turning, coiling the upper body around it. It was almost like generating the torque that you would have in a catapult. You know, one of the interesting things, though, about Edgar, that when I first started researching this, nobody knew him. I contacted some of my friends at the R&A, the Royal and Ancient Golf Club at St. Andrews, since he was originally from England, the USGA, as well as the PGA of America, and this man finished second in the PGA Championship the year before he died. Nobody ever heard of him.
Edgar shares top billing in your book with a 20-year-old Atlanta newspaper reporter named Comer Howell. Howell encounters Edgar late one August night in 1921 after Edgar has apparently been struck by a car, at least that's what Howell thinks, fatally struck by a car, as it turns out. What made you decide to make Comer Howell a central focus of the book?
Well, I think that any time you have a mysterious death, you wonder, what was it that led people to say, gee, this is something other than a routine hit and run? And that person was Comer Howell, who initially believed it was a hit and run accident, primarily because all of the news that week in Atlanta had been the fact that it was Traffic Safety Awareness Week. So,
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh at that, but the idea that people should have assumed that because, what the heck, it was Traffic Safety Awareness Week in Atlanta.
It's kind of funny, if you think about this was the first generation of the automobile. And so traffic safety was a huge issue simply because people weren't very good at it. A lot of people were actually hit and killed in the street by cars they had seen. They just simply underestimated the closing speed of a Model T because they were accustomed to seeing horses and carriages. Atlanta had attempted to implement Traffic Safety Awareness Week to heighten the awareness of being careful on the roads. That had been the lead story in all of the newspapers. Comer had just closed out an issue where it is all he had written about for the entire day. As he's driving home, he sees a man bleeding to death in the street. The logical assumption is that it is a traffic accident.
Now, in 1920, the year before he died, Douglas Edgar wrote that, and I'm quoting now, "Golf is truly a goddess and must be wooed accordingly with due meekness and humility, but at the same time with boldness and determination." Is it fair to say that Mr. Edgar knew something about wooing sub-deities as well?
Well, he knew a lot about wooing. There's no doubt about that. Edgar was a bit of a social animal. He was the life of every party he attended, particularly in Newcastle. After World War I, when he came over to America, Prohibition had just gotten underway. And so he was missing the good times. And he attempted to go find pleasures in some of the seedier areas of the town and in some places that he shouldn't have been.
Comer Howell testified at the inquest following the death of Edgar that he had doubts that Edgar had been hit by a car. Howell thought that he had bled to death after being stabbed. To what extent did the authorities follow up on those doubts?
There was one investigator, the lead detective, who did indeed feel as though he needed to follow up on the idea of a stabbing. Unfortunately, the entire political machine in Atlanta at that point really wanted this to be a hit and run for a number of reasons. For starters, again, because people were attempting to draw awareness to traffic safety, you had the mayor and the police chief who were attempting to parlay that idea into more police officers on the street, greater budgets, that sort of thing. Boosterism, particularly among residents in the South, was a big deal at that time. People wanted the world to think highly of their city, particularly in a city like Atlanta, which had had something of a sordid past with racial riots, and there had been a lynching of Leo Frank, a Jewish merchant at the time. That was the catalyst for the Anti-Defamation League actually being formed. So there was a political motivation, but also because he was a golf professional at a very exclusive private club, considering Edgar's reputation with the women in Atlanta, I think people were extremely frightened of which names might actually come out.
I'm speaking with Steve Eubanks, author of To Win and Die in Dixie, and you're listening to Only a Game. Though the official classification of the passing of Douglas Edgar is still unsolved death, you seem to be suggesting at the end of To Win and Die in Dixie that a fellow named William K. Abbey may well have been involved. What's the basis for that suspicion?
It was always rumored that Edgar had had a fling with the florist's wife at the club where he was the golf professional. Well, it turns out that by the time Comer Howell found Edgar in the street, the florist there was a nice elderly lady. So that was sort of immediately written off. What nobody looked into at the time was that 2 years prior, the florist at the club was Mr. William K. Abbey, a Japanese gentleman who owned a hotel in Atlanta as well. He had a very beautiful Asian wife, and one of the things that Comer Howell discovered late is that Mrs. Abbey took quite an interest in Edgar's grave.
He found her, in fact, standing weeping at the graveside.
That's correct, yes, stroking the headstone, weeping at the graveside. It's interesting because the lead investigator very much believed that Abbey was, in fact, involved and kept up with him for quite some time thereafter. In fact, all the way up until his death in the 1930s.
Listen, as long as you're down there in Georgia, anything golf-related going on down there?
Well, you know, we have a little tournament over about 50 miles east of Atlanta. The Masters is rolling around, as it always does this time of year, only this year I think it's coming around with a slight more interest than it has in perhaps years past.
Now, is that true of people in Georgia as well? Because I've sort of been imagining that, you know, folks who are down there and kind of accustomed to the Masters rolling around every year, as you say, are sort of saying, well, you know, we're not going to allow this to be that big a deal just because Tiger Woods is coming back.
Well, I don't think they have much say in the matter. I would assume that particularly the police department in Augusta would much prefer that he stay home next week, because you can imagine it is going to be something of a circus, particularly outside the gates. Now, within the confines of Augusta National, it will be as it always is, a very controlled environment, very pristine, golf claps, that sort of thing. But outside the gates, you can imagine it's going to be, as I have called it before, Britney Spears kind of crazy.
Steve Eubanks is the author of To Win and Die in Dixie, The Birth of the Modern Golf Swing and the Mysterious Death of Its Creator. The book is published by Ballantine, and Steve Eubanks joined me from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Steve, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
A golfer who makes an eagle is often surprised at his good fortune and almost certainly proud. Making an eagle means you've holed out in three on a par five or finished a par four in just two shots. So why did a certain golfer in Wabasso, Florida, feel so bad after his eagle on the second hole of the Sandridge Golf Course on Tuesday that he didn't want to reveal his name? Because the still unidentified Linkster's golf ball collided with an actual eagle, knocking the stunned bird to the fairway whence it flopped into a pond. The chagrined marksman recovered the fowl, which is now itself recovering, at the Treasure Coast Wildlife Hospital in Fort Pierce. Unlucky birdie, that eagle, but he'll apparently fly again. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a story Charlie Pierce might actually stick around to listen to. Pole dancing is sport. You can shout sports if you like. But first, I am joined by said Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
How many stories can you do about Tiger Woods in one broadcast is what I want to know.
Oh, I could see that one coming way around the bend. You acknowledged some time ago that your brackets had disintegrated and that you were watching the NCAA tournaments for entertainment purposes only, as so many of us are at this point. But there has been some excellent entertainment, eh?
Been terrific entertainment. All of postseason basketball, I recommend highly the NIT game between Mississippi and Texas Tech for an appetizer, which I happen to watch because I happen to have nothing else to do. You know, certainly Xavier and Kansas State is going to be a game people remember. And you've got a Final Four that is, at the very least, interesting for its participants.
Duke is one of those participants. While arch-rival North Carolina, UNC, failed to even make the big dance, Carolina then lost to Dayton in Thursday's NIT Finals. Have Tar Heel fans ever had such cause for lamentation as they have now?
Oh, yes, they have in the past. In fact, Dean Smith's first year there was a dismal failure. But that team cannot stay bad forever. I suspect you are going to see some people decide to take their games to another university in the offseason, though.
Whether or not that team stays bad, by golly, it's likely to be in the NCAA tournament next year because they're talking about having 96 teams there.
You're going to cry 96 teams. You're going to cry 96 teams. This is a profoundly, almost epically stupid idea. This idea is so dumb only the NCAA could come up with it. Unfortunately, there's one problem in modern life, Bill, you can't overcome, and that is when the people who have a really stupid idea are the people perfectly positioned to put it into practice. So it's going to happen. It's going to demolish what's all that's good about the tournaments. But the problem is, of course, that by the time they throw the ball up in the 96-team tournament, nobody's going to remember. All they're going to know is they're going to need two pieces of paper for the brackets next year.
Louisville men's basketball coach Rick Pitino said this week, quote, "My moving days have long been over," and fortunately for Coach Pitino, I guess his current employer agreed.
Yes, they've extended him through 2017. You know, he makes about $2.5 million a year. He may finally have, I mean, I can't believe the NBA bug is completely out of his bloodstream, but I think he's looked around and thought this is the best deal he can get.
On another level altogether, Senator Scott Brown, R. Massachusetts, has said that he and his daughter, Ayla, who's a player at Boston College, would like to go 2-on-2 against Barack Obama and a partner. And if Senator Brown figured the president might show up with one of his daughters, I guess he was mistaken.
No, Maya Moore of the soon-to-be, oh, what the heck, just crown him now anyway, Lady Huskies of the University of Connecticut has volunteered, as she said, in her patriotic duty to help him out.
I think she might help him out considerably.
Well, at least Ayla Brown will be playing against a player she's familiar with.
Absolutely. L.A. Laker Ron Artest will soon have his own reality television show, which the producers say will allow him to, quote, make amends for past transgressions, which is pretty much what reality television shows are all about. This one at least is aptly named.
No, maybe it will be a redemption tour. Who knows? All I do know is that one of the producers of the proposed news show, They Call Me Crazy, by the way, is something called Tijuana Entertainment. And what could possibly go wrong?
What could go wrong with that? Absolutely. As the Major League clubs prepare to leave their camps in Florida and Arizona, Major League Baseball said this week that there may be some spring training games in Italy as early as next year. You think the Italians will be amused?
The cheering you hear in the distance is all those people who have to go to little towns in Florida every spring suddenly being presented with a little time in Sicily. Yes, this will be the most popular thing for baseball writers since the invention of sunscreen.
Denard Span of the Minnesota Twins is renewing his call for more netting to protect fans from fly balls. And after what happened on Wednesday during a spring training game, he makes a better case than most.
Yeah, the poor guy hit his own mother, which is certainly irony enough for an entire career. I remember Wade Boggs talking about this, about how he wouldn't let his kids sit along either baseline because of the same thing.
The Yankees aren't the first team to have an ambidextrous pitcher in their organization, Charlie. But
an amphibious pitcher?
I have a frog in my throat, and I thought perhaps it leapt onto the actual content.
Excellent. He does topical humor, too.
In any case, an ambidextrous pitcher is in the Yankees organization. This has happened before, but they let this guy change arms within an inning in a Grapefruit League game.
Well, they let him throw with both arms. Yeah. He didn't change and unscrew one arm and put it on the other side.
I misread that.
I mean, this is not Inspector Gadget we have pitching here. No, Pat Venditti. Yeah, he's 24 years old. He wears a six-finger glove so he can flip from back and forth. And apparently, among other people, C.C. Sabathia thought this was about the coolest thing he'd ever seen. He said it felt like they kept changing pitchers before I figured out what was happening. Now, I'm not saying that players tend to, like, wool gather through the last couple of weeks of spring training, but not noticing that you hadn't changed pitchers because the pitcher hadn't changed is really kind of letting your mind wander a bit.
Pete Rose was in the news this week, and it seems he's doing everything he can to enhance his candidacy for the Hall of Fame, don't you think?
Well, now, the guy has a new 29-year-old girlfriend who's 40 years younger than he is, and she happens to be in Playboy, and he's helping her tour the upcoming Playboy magazine, in which his girlfriend appears in considerably less than your average Cincinnati Reds road uniform. I don't think there's any way this keeps him out of the Hall of Fame. I think he's got bigger problems than that, but what are you going to do?
The NFL seems to have entered the season in which players make excuses for past performances, and LaDainian Tomlinson is tops on that list. He said this week that his disappointing seasons were the fault of the Chargers, 1, fullbacks, 2, linemen, 3, quarterback, and 4, coach. Did he leave anybody out?
Yes, himself. Ah. I mean, the argument he's making is he didn't run very well last year because they didn't let him run enough because they changed their offense. Well, I would argue that they changed their offense because he couldn't run anymore.
Gamblers with no imagination may be betting that Tiger Woods will win the Masters, which begins on Thursday, or they may be betting that he won't win the Masters. But for the gambler who does have an imagination, what are some of the other Tiger-related options?
Well, I think the safest one we can mention on the air is the betting that he'll hit a tree with his first drive, because there's another one about whether or not he will, quote, kiss an anonymous blonde before teeing off. First of all, I presume that means on the course, because how would they know otherwise?
That's got to be within camera range.
If he kisses a blonde that, like, we're aware of, like one of his 9,000 girlfriends that have come out in the last 6 months, do you lose your bet because she's not anonymous anymore? Inquiring minds need to know before we invest in things like this.
And finally, Charlie, you have no doubt been to baseball games where they served ice cream in cups that looked like those little miniature colorful batting helmets, but it looks as if the minor league Toledo Mudhens have taken that gag a giant step further.
They have. It is a 15-scoop sundae called the Fanatic Freeze, and it's served in a full-size
batting helmet.
And I noticed from the hat that it doesn't have the ear flap, which I guess they're saving for next year when this thing gets even bigger.
Well, they'll make the ear flap out of some sort of chocolate cookie or some brownie that can go with the sundae, I'm sure.
Okay.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
An intriguing headline hit the wires in February as the Vancouver Olympics were ongoing. Pole dancing, the next Olympic sport? The pole dance workout craze began a few years back with everyone from the Desperate Housewives to Martha Stewart taking a spin. And while the sport is likely decades away from Olympic recognition, much less inclusion, Only a Game's Karen Given felt it was time to take a peek at the world of competitive pole dancing.
Say the words pole dancing, and most people picture a dark, smoke-filled bar and men whose eyes have glazed over from too many overpriced drinks. But the U.S. National Pole Dancing Championship is being staged in the Bright Performance Hall at Symphony Space on Manhattan's Upper West Side. The marquee on Broadway proudly announces that the main event will take place at 7:30. But don't expect to walk up to the box office and buy a ticket. The event is completely sold out. Inside Symphony Space, women like Jeremy and her friends from Pole-A-Tees in Atlanta, Georgia, are excited about tonight's competition. Jeremy says she's a lover of all things pole dance.
I say all the time it's the most fun you can have with your clothes on. And like I said, it tells a story, not just the story of how I want to put your money in my pants, but about where you got your pants from and how sexy it is to run, swing around the pole in them. It's confidence that they do have sometimes in those clubs, but it's something so much more. It's empowerment for women the way we feel it.
Jeremy is the stereotypical pole dance success story. She says the sport has been life-changing.
When I started pole dancing, I was actually about 47% body fat, like 265, 270 on a good day if I had a little cheese. I lost 24% of my body fat in the first year. It just was phenomenal as far as like decreasing the body fat, my strength, my upper body strength. It's a whole body transformation.
It's taken about 5 years for pole dancing to really make the transition from strip club to performance venue. But Leanne Riley, one of 12 finalists and the owner of B Spun in Hollywood, California, says she's not surprised to see the 700-seat theater filled with women like Jeremy.
Oh yeah, these are all women that participate in the sport. I mean, guys go to strip clubs for what they go to strip clubs for. This is completely different. This is a performance art that just happens to use a vertical pole.
Pole dancers are scored on their transitions, technique, execution, originality, flexibility, and original style. Like in figure skating, there's a compulsory round where competitors must perform certain tricks, and an optional round where they're encouraged to break new ground. And although quite a bit of bare skin is needed to grip the pole and perform more advanced moves, Leanne says nudity is strictly prohibited.
The truth is, it is extremely athletic. I mean, it takes strength, grace, flexibility, fluidity, balance, and you can absolutely compete in it. I mean, you put these girls up, you give them criteria, and you see who's the best.
2.5 hours before the main event, the press is invited to watch the competitors take a few warm-up spins. Jesselyn Maderi has been practicing her routines every day for a few weeks now, and all that practice has taken its toll. Pole dancers don't just swing around the pole with their hands. They turn upside down and hang by their legs or their underarms or even their stomachs. They climb to the top of the pole and loosen their grip, plummeting towards the stage. Sometimes they fall headfirst and stop themselves right before they crash. Other times they land in the splits. Like most of today's finalists, Jesselyn has a laundry list of injuries.
So I snagged my ear last week. I've caught my neck before, and you can see I've bruised right here on my shoulder. My tummy has lost a lot of skin around my belly button, so I'm missing some of that right now. But other than that, I've got a lot of chest pain from lifting up and letting my weight crash down on me. But I think I've pulled a hamstring recently. I'm saying recently. It's probably been hurting 3 months. I've got a really bad burn on the right side of my right knee, and I broke my 2 left toes last week, and that was fun.
And you're still in those heels.
It's going to be worth it. When this is all over, I'll go see a doctor. But right now, they're not really attached. So it'll be awesome.
Many of the finalists are pole dance instructors like Jesselyn and Leanne. Others are elementary school teachers, grad students, and moms. Gabrielle Valliere is finishing up her final semester of nursing school, and she teaches pole dance on the side. Gabrielle was a cheerleader for the New England Patriots for 5 years, so she's no stranger to skin-bearing outfits. But she says her family didn't quite get it when she made the transition from NFL cheerleader to competitive pole dancer.
Oh, God. I'm glad they're coming today. I'm so glad that they'll actually have an opportunity to see what it is that I do and how hard I have to work and how difficult it is, yet how artistic and beautiful it is. I'm so happy that they're coming and can really see what I've been up to and don't think that I'm, you know, shaking my money maker for a couple of dollar bills somewhere, because it's certainly the complete antithesis of that.
Are you guys ready for your first competitor?
As a slightly nervous Gabrielle takes the stage for the compulsory round, one of the women in the audience shouts, "You're hot." Gabrielle has 90 seconds to make it through the required moves, including floor work, 2 spins, a spinning inversion, a split, a pirouette, and a handstand on the pole. The sport is still too young to have a standardized glossary of tricks, which means that people like Allegra, Miss Pole Dance Australia, can name their own moves.
The Allegra is, it's sort of a really contorted sort of a move. It's a bit hard to explain. My arm is behind my knee, my top leg is straight, my bottom leg is bent, and I'm grabbing onto my foot.
Competitive pole dancers each have their own style. Zariah Judd's might be the most distinctive. She moves fluidly from one perfectly held strength move to another, almost as if she was demonstrating advanced yoga moves while hanging 10 or more feet in the air. Zariah is a mom and fitness instructor from Salt Lake City who had a most unusual introduction to pole.
I was the only girl in an all-man class. We did no sexy spins or floor work or anything like that. It was all strength and like crazy circusy flips and stuff like that.
So what's your favorite part of doing this?
The fitness part, like the control and the strength. Ooh. And dressing up, of course.
Put your hands together, New York City, for Alethea Austin.
Alethea Austin made her living as a photographer until she discovered pole dancing. She says she's been doing gymnastics since birth, but came to pole dancing as a way to rehab neck and shoulder injuries from a serious car accident. Alethea had only been pole dancing for a year at the 2009 championships, but she still managed a second-place finish. She promises her tricks have only gotten better.
Oh, they're much bigger. They're much bigger. When I can't even look at my routine last year. I mean, it's emotional to me because I loved the song and I loved it being my first time, but I was a baby poler compared. We all sort of have really trained and learned and progressed together this last year.
Costumes and props are allowed in the optional round, and the lights come up on Alethea, handcuffed to the pole. Despite the restriction, she still manages to twist and spin and contort into dozens of positions. It's easy to see why her routine, which offers equal parts athleticism and artistic impression, impresses the judges.
The U.S. pole dance champion 2010 is Alethea Austin.
For her first place win, Alethea takes home a $5,000 check, round-trip airfare to Australia, and a dozen other prizes. It's a far cry from an Olympic gold medal, but the petition to include pole dancing in the 2012 Games in London currently has more than 4,000 signatures. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
To view our exceedingly tasteful pole dancing photo gallery, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Tyler Murray. We had help this week from Jim Kiesling and from Tom Barkley at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, or listen to archived shows and stories, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on our Facebook and Twitter pages at Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from pole dance competitor Leanne Riley.
My husband, who's a retired professional fighter, gets on the pole once in a while and says, like, oh, how do you guys do this? Like, I made my living, like, in a sport that the whole point is to hurt the other person, and this hurts too much for me to even do it.
It sounds to me like hubby ought to work a bit on his threshold of pain. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.